Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. This program is made possible by the generous support of Chevron and the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation. I'm Jane Wales. Today we'll be in conversation with two well-known journalists on the pressing national security and foreign policy issues of the day. First, we'll be in conversation with David Sanger. David is the chief Washington correspondent for the New York Times. We'll then talk to Janine Zakaria. She's the former Jerusalem bureau chief and Middle East correspondent for The Washington Post. She now teaches at Stanford University. But first, a word about David Sanger. David leads national security coverage for The New York Times. He has reported from New York, from Washington, from Tokyo, where he was the bureau chief. He was a member of two teams that won the Pulitzer Prize, and he's the author of two books. The first is entitled The Inheritance, The World Obama Confronts and the Challenges of American Power. His second book is entitled Confront and Conceal, Obama's Secret Wars and the Surprising Use of American Power. He'll have a new book coming out on cyber warfare in the months ahead. So, David, what do you make of the recent talks between North Korea and South Korea and the fact that President Trump welcomed them?
Well, I don't think you can read too much into it. But when President Trump says that he is partly responsible for forcing the North Koreans to come to the table here, I think that this is actually one Trumpian claim that's got some truth to it. And that's because the North Koreans were feeling the pressure a couple of different ways. One, they're worried about American attack. Secondly, they're worried that the Chinese really were coming over on side to the U.S. We know that in November there was very little, if any, direct oil shipment between China and North Korea. That was hurting. We've gotten anecdotal reports of price hikes and shortages of both of refined oil products. So Kim has got to have gotten worried about this. Kim Jong-un has gotten worried about this.
And of course, he saw that the Chinese voted with us on ratcheting up the sanctions.
That's right.
The Security Council.
Twice in a row.
Yeah.
And so did the Russians, who, you know, sort of had to because they weren't given any cover by the Chinese. So he did something that was pretty canny, and which comes a little bit out of his grandfather's playbook, as most things do for Kim Jong-un, which is that he saw an opportunity to try to peel the South Koreans away from the United States, their ally of 70 years. And he did that because he had the incredible opportunity of these Olympics.
Mm-hmm.
So the South Koreans had one big worry, which was that North Korea would in some way spoil the Olympics, a terror attack, a missile test, a nuclear test, some kind of confrontation someplace. So they wanted to make sure that didn't happen, which is why they so desperately wanted the North Koreans to come in with an Olympic team here. Would not be the first time the North Koreans have had an Olympic team. In fact, they were in Rio in 2016. They won 7 medals.
Mm.
Short of Kim Jong-un's national goal of 12, but 7's perfectly respectable, right? So that was a South Korean desire. The North Korean desire was to throw a wrench into any opportunity the president might have, President Trump might have, to come out of the Olympics launching any kind of preemptive military strike and lining the Chinese up for more sanctions. And all the Chinese wanted to be able to see was that the two sides were talking, so they could say to President Trump, hey, you know, this is an inter-Korean thing, time for us to step out of the way. Mm-hmm. And it's brilliant, because the one thing the South Koreans and the North Koreans aren't going to be discussing is the nuclear program and the missile program.
Now, he also gained some time. Kim, the leader of North Korea, in the sense that he needs time to be able to have the kinds of small miniaturized warheads that he can affix atop his intercontinental ballistic missiles. How long do we know? How long it's going to take him to get where he needs to be?
We don't. The CIA director said the other day that it would be just a matter of months. But then again, he said that to me in the summer.
Mm-hmm.
So, look, the North Koreans have done 95% of what they need to do. They've learned how to enrich uranium. They've learned how to take plutonium and manufacture those into bombs. They've learned how to construct missiles that can go in their last big successful test 8,100 miles, although it was on a very high arc. That's plenty of reach to be able to get to, if you flattened it out, to get to Washington or New York. They've detonated now 6 nuclear tests. If you look back over the history of the Soviet program, the U.S. program, the Chinese program, the Indians, by the time you've done that number of tests, you've pretty well figured it out. The one thing they hadn't gotten to, as you suggested, was making sure that you could make a warhead that's small and survivable, because when they're re-entering the atmosphere on a missile, an intercontinental ballistic missile, there's lots of heat, there's lots of vibration, and there's lots of opportunity for the warhead to burn up. And that took us a while. So the U.S. has been doing everything it could to slow down this program, including cyber options against them. We can come back to those later. But everybody I talk to thinks that while this is rocket science, literally, they'll figure it out.
So you said that when we were talking about why Kim came to the table, that he is fearful of an attack from the United States. Is one of President Trump's accomplishments that he has persuaded Kim of that? That these are not empty threats, that it is real, that this is a president willing to use new military options, no matter how risky.
I think that he has certainly put more fear into Kim Jong-un's heart than Barack Obama did. And that's because President Obama was extremely cautious for all the good reasons. Because he was focused on keeping Iran from getting the kind of capability that North Korea ultimately had. He kind of saw the North Korean program in the rearview mirror and believed there was almost nothing that the Obama administration could do to get North Korea to give up its nuclear weapons and its missile program. And he was probably right on that. But the result was that he didn't focus as much on some of the basics that President Trump has done that has forced, I think, the North Koreans to go reconsider. There's no reason the Obama administration could not have stepped up the sanctions on North Korea the way President Trump has. There's no reason the Obama administration couldn't have very strictly enforced the existing sanctions, couldn't have put more naval power out there, couldn't have threatened to interdict North Korean ships at sea. And when you go and you find members of the Obama administration and ask why they didn't focus on it, particularly in the last few years, they don't really come up with terribly convincing answers. Other than the fact that the CIA was still saying that the North Koreans were 4 to 6 years away to having a weapon. When President Trump came in, the briefing that he got in early 2017 said that it would be 2020, maybe 2022, before the North Koreans could actually strike an American city. That turned out to be pretty optimistic.
Yeah. And in fact, the agency has gotten it wrong several times on North Korea. It's a pretty hard place to have human intelligence.
It's a hard place to have human intelligence. The oddity is we reported in a fairly lengthy piece last week that I did with my colleague Bill Broad, is that starting in 2000, they had a very good strategic sense at the CIA and the National Intelligence Council of how long it would take the North Koreans to get to this point. And they said sometime between 2015 and 2020. It was when they got in close that they missed how the North had parallel produced different kinds of missiles, including one kind, the kind that they've now been testing for these long-range tests, that use an old Soviet rocket engine. And I think we kind of missed the transfer of that technology and whatever was done to make it indigenous inside North Korea.
So I was going to ask you, what kind of outside help has North Korea gotten in both in developing its missiles, but also its capacity to enrich uranium?
So the uranium enrichment came largely from Pakistan and from AQ Khan, who was, of course, one of the fathers of the Pakistani nuclear program. And back, I guess now, in 2003, 2004, we spent 14 months on an investigation to kind of prove that AQ Khan was the source of a lot of this North Korean enrichment capability. This is before the North Koreans had even tested their first nuclear weapon. And it was an interesting experience because if you think of that period of time, 03, 04, the U.S. desperately needed Pakistan in the war in Afghanistan and did everything they could to throw blockades in our way as we were reporting this out for the evidence that it was the Pakistanis who were supplying North Korea.
Rather not know.
They knew. Rather not have it made public, embarrass the Pakistanis, and make it harder to get help on counterterrorism. We persisted anyway, went around the world, collected up the evidence, brought it back to Washington. At that point, they couldn't sort of like deny it. So we've known now for 14 years that there was a big enrichment program that AQ Khan sold to North Korea, to Iran, to Libya. We don't know who else he may have gotten that to. So that was on the nuclear side. They had already had plutonium from a reactor they were building starting in the 1980s. And that reactor is so old that the early CIA documents documenting its discovery from the early 80s have just been declassified. And the problem's still here. That's when haven't solved one. On the missile side, most of the help came from China, but most of it has come in for the more recent stuff from Russia, both for solid fuel technologies, submarine-launched missiles, and then these big liquid-fueled engines that they've been putting in.
And to what extent are we talking about Russian government action, and to what extent was there help from rogue scientists after the Soviet Union came apart?
It's a great question. We think if there was much help from Russia, it's probably more from rogue scientists. You know, the U.S. and Russia did a very good job after the collapse of the Soviet Union of finding work for nuclear scientists.
Yeah, the civilian R&D foundation that was established.
That's right. The Nunn-Lugar bill took a lot of the material out, brought it back to the United States where it was burned off for, you know, electric power. But we did a terrible job, or no job, with the missile scientists. We were so focused on the nuclear side that we paid very little attention to the missile side. And some of them were stopped by the Russians from going to North Korea, but others made it. And the North Koreans were willing to pay significant money. And, you know, you can bring those designs with you electronically, on paper. And so here we are, more than 25 years after the collapse of the Soviet Union, and we're beginning to see old Soviet-designed missiles be launched with pretty good success rates by the Russians. By the North Koreans.
By the North Koreans. So we talked about the ways in which President Trump may have played it right. One, ratcheting up the sanctions. Two, putting forth a perhaps credible case of launching fire and fury, or whatever his phrase was. And but let's talk about what the military options for President Trump actually are, and what are the risks associated with it.
The problem is you can have a new president who talks up a good storm on this and who ratchets it up the sanctions. But the military options are no better than they were for any of his predecessors. And it's important to remember sort of how we got here. The North Koreans, back to the era of George H.W. Bush, would do some incremental increase in their program, start up the reactor at Yongbyon, test missiles, test their nuclear weapons. And for each one, every American president, first President Bush, Bill Clinton, second President Bush, President Obama, each had to ask themselves the question, is this incremental increase, awful as it may be, worth risking Seoul and risking a military action that could take out millions of people?
Mm-hmm.
And each time, each one of them came to the conclusion, no, it's not worth the risk. And if you look at any one of those decisions in isolation, they're perfectly reasonable. You and I would probably have come out to the exact same place. But you add them up over a quarter century, and you get a full-blown nuclear program, mm-hmm. exactly like the one that we see in North Korea today. So that raises the question, you know, for each one of these, you think you're doing the prudent thing, and you are, but over the long range, you make your cities vulnerable to a North Korean nuclear weapon. Now, that's not a problem if you believe that classic containment, what we used on the Soviet Union, will keep the North Koreans from ever launching something at the United States. And I'm actually a believer that in most cases, that will probably work. But there are some exceptions to this. There could be some other kind of incident that begins in a non-nuclear way.
Mm-hmm.
The North Koreans shoot down an American surveillance plane the way they did in 1969. Nixon did not respond, but it killed more than 30 Americans. I'm not sure Donald Trump would show the same restraint. The North Koreans sink a South Korean ship, as they did 4 or 5 years ago, and killed 30 or 40 members of the crew. The North Koreans open up fire on a South Korean position, as they did 4 or 5 years ago. There's an incident at sea as we're trying to intercept a ship that we suspect of carrying UN banned goods. The North Koreans don't allow a party to board. There's an exchange of fire. The U.S. takes the ship and drops it to the bottom of the Sea of Japan, and you're off to the races. And the one that worries me the most is actually that the U.S. gets its wish and the North Korean regime begins to collapse.
Mm.
And suddenly there's a scramble for 20 to 60 nuclear weapons, depending on whose estimates you believe. And the Chinese coming in trying to secure nuclear sites and missile sites. And the Americans trying to land special forces to secure the same sites. And the South Koreans coming up over the border and thinking about securing the same sites. Boy, you've got the formula there for a big problem. And then some North Korean, you know, general or colonel somewhere who's got command over a separate nuclear unit thinks, well, the regime's collapsing anyway, we might as well take someone with us. Those are all the conditions under which classic containment would not work.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, there's a general thought that the last thing you want to do is corner someone who is far weaker with far, far less capability because they escalate more quickly.
That's right.
And of course, if you think back to the Cuban Missile Crisis and more recently learning that, in fact, there were short-range nuclear weapons, at least according to the former Soviet admiral, he had short-range nuclear weapons. And
already on Cuba.
Already on Cuba and permission to use them. And when Castro learned that, he said, if I'd known it, I would have said use them.
So
he had nothing to lose.
This is such a fascinating insight, and you're absolutely right. And it's a fascinating insight because Kennedy went through the entire Cuban Missile Crisis on what today we would call an intelligence failure.
Mm-hmm.
We were doing the entire thing to prevent nuclear weapons from showing up in Cuba. And it turns out they were already there.
And a different kind,
effectively. A different kind that we had not known about, but that probably could have made it to Florida. And certainly you could have put a weapon on a barge and taken it off to Florida. And so that tells you that you go into these things confident in intelligence that may simply, for no one's fault, be wrong.
Yeah, and yet, well, he also ended up relying on the least likely wisehead in the room, and that's his 36-year-old brother, to give it advice during it. But we won't get too deep into the Cuban Missile Crisis. I want to go back to this concept of state collapse, because you can imagine with the sanctions that are on these folks, or on North Korea, that is not an unthinkable or it is quite a possible outcome. What are we prepared to do? I know you've reported on this. What is the U.S. prepared to do in the face of that, and what's China prepared to do?
So the U.S. has trained for this many times, not only in North Korea, but in other places, where we've got special forces units that go in with what are called render-safe units that would seize a nuclear weapon and render it safe, make it inert, and then you can worry about later on how you get it out of the country. The problem is that we've run into is that the Chinese have never wanted to engage in a direct conversation with us about how we would keep our forces from coming into conflict with each other. And it's a big issue. And the Chinese don't want to go get in that conversation because they're afraid that once they do get in that conversation and it leaks out, it looks like they've abandoned their long-time ally, even if that is the most strained relationship out there. And because, frankly, they don't trust us. So a few weeks ago, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson was giving a talk here in Washington. It was at the Atlantic Council, and it was a Korea conference. And he starts talking about Korea, and maybe because he didn't know about the sensitivity of this history, maybe because he didn't know that this was considered so secret by the special forces, he starts talking about how he's been discussing this issue with the Chinese. Now, he doesn't say what the Chinese are saying back. But that was the first public indication we've ever had that the U.S. has been trying to get the Chinese to go focus on this problem.
And what you also learned that we were ready to have the special forces go in, but then what?
Right. Tillerson said that he had already assured the Chinese that we would not stay. We would go in, grab those nukes, secure those missiles, get out of town, go south of the 38th parallel. So what he was essentially saying was, if you want the territory of North Korea, either it's yours, or you and the South Koreans work it out, but we're not going to hang around. And it was a very smart thing to assure the Chinese of privately, because their biggest fear is we come, we stay, and we're right up on their border. But at the same time, it sort of outed that these discussions are happening. And I discovered this with, the oldest investigative reporting technique in the book. I read the transcript of the public document that was Tillerson's talk at the Atlantic Council, and I looked at this and I said, and I sent it around to some friends in the Pentagon, and I said, you ever seen a government official talk about this in public? And some of them came back with some vivid language about what they would do to a public official who talked about this in public. But when that public official is the Secretary of State and he's already given the speech, what can you do?
What can you do? Now, do we have the precise knowledge we need to succeed in securing their weapons material and their weapons? Do we know how much they have of plutonium and how they're generated? Do we know where it is, where the technologies are? What is our level of intelligence on these things?
Not good. Yeah. The consensus estimate is that the North Koreans have 20, maybe upwards of 30 nuclear weapons, somewhere in that range. The Defense Intelligence Agency has put out a number north of 50. So imagine for a minute that you're the Special Forces Commander and you're out there securing nuclear weapons, and you get there and the president gets on the phone with you and says, how's it going? What are you supposed to say? Terrific, sir. We've got 20? Well, 20 out of how many? I'm not certain.
Yeah, yeah.
That isn't really the confidence-building answer you want to hear.
So let's move on to the question of, were we to make it to the negotiating table? I mean, President Trump has said, under the right conditions, he's willing, he personally is willing, to meet with Kim. with the North Korean leader. Thus far, we've defined the right conditions for any kind of negotiations at a much lower level, that the right conditions are that that they have renounced their nuclear capability. If we were to say denuclearization is the goal for talks as opposed to the conditions for talks, would we have a live conversation?
Well, I think that's probably what we're going to have to do. The position of the United States is the goal of these talks is to denuclearize the entire Korean Peninsula. That's been the U.S. position over many previous presidential administrations. Complete, verifiable disarmament. The North Korean position is the exact opposite. Our nuclear program is not for negotiation. We're happy to talk to you about arms control, limit the numbers. We're happy to talk to you about freezing. They haven't been happy so far to do it, but we think they would be happy to discuss freezing their nuclear tests and their missile tests in return for our freezing our training programs, our joint training programs between the U.S. military and the South Koreans. Mm-hmm. But if you're freezing the North Korean program today in 2018, that's a very different thing than freezing it in 2008.
Yeah,
because it's an up-and-running program at this point. So you would be freezing a complete North Korean capability in place rather than being where you would have been 10 years ago, which was freezing them in place before they had demonstrated that they could launch a missile that can reach the United States, before they had detonated enough nuclear weapons that we know that they're capable of doing it.
Yeah. I interviewed Wendy Sherman for this show as well. She led the negotiations with Iran. And during the Obama administration and during the Clinton administration, she had some responsibility also for policy regarding North Korea. She argues that the fact that the president is talking about reneging on the Iran nuclear deal undercuts any efforts to get Kim to the table, get Kim to negotiate, get the North to negotiate seriously, even an arms control agreement, let alone denuclearization. Is that a consensus view amongst policy?
I don't know if it's a consensus view, but I'm certainly sympathetic to Wendy's argument here. Because the core of this is that the United States spent 4 or 5 years negotiating, first not terribly intensely, then very intensely, with the Iranians to get to what became the 2015 accord. And I was covering each step along the way, so I know how long and painful it was. And if the next administration can just walk away from that and say, we just don't think the deal is good enough, what would stop Kim from reasonably thinking that anything he negotiated with Donald Trump would be walked away from by whoever the next president is?
Yep.
Nothing.
Yep.
You know, he barely trusts us as it is. So that's what makes it somewhat remarkable to me. When I raise this with people in the administration, they say, no, they're totally separate issues. Our objections on the Iran side are completely different than our objections on North Korea. Different strategies, different strokes for different countries. And my answer to that is, makes sense to me, but I don't count. Does it make sense to Kim Jong-un?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. David Sanger, we're looking forward to your next book, which will be on cybersecurity. I think that comes out in the fall.
It'll be on cyber conflict sometime mid 2018. And I'm looking forward to getting it finished.
Thank you for taking the time.
Thank you.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. It's made possible by the support of Chevron and the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation. I'm Jane Wales. We've been in conversation with David Sanger of the New York Times, and we'll now turn to a conversation with Janine Zakaria, former Jerusalem bureau chief for the Washington Post. You not only, Janine, covered Jerusalem and the Middle East for the Washington Post, but you also covered Washington for the Jerusalem Post. And that puts you in a unique position to talk about the response domestically, response there to the Jerusalem decision. Many of our allies thought that when President Trump announced that he would recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital, they thought there'd be another intifada. There hasn't been. What has been the response on the streets, and why?
Well, I think that there were some protests in the immediate aftermath of President Trump's announcement declaration in early December that Jerusalem is the capital of Israel. But the bigger consequences, the more meaningful and long-term consequence has been that the U.S. has made itself sort of obsolete in the minds of the Palestinians as a neutral broker in the peace process. So that has been the way it's gone for the past two decades. And some will argue, as President Trump did, that it hasn't worked the way it's been going. So he threw this wrench into it. But what it's done is it has left the perception among Palestinians and in the Arab world, even if there is not the overt intifada that you mentioned, that the U.S. cannot mediate any longer between Israel and the Palestinians because he so definitively took Israel's side in the question of Jerusalem, which is one of the paramount final status issues to be negotiated.
How about the effect on other parties to the negotiation? I think of Mahmoud Abbas, the president of the Palestinian Authority. Has this undermined him? Has it shown that he can't deliver the goods?
Absolutely, it undermines him. And you have a situation now where Mahmoud Abbas has, with whatever problems people want to say, obviously he's also not really democratically in power anymore because they haven't had elections in a long time because of the threat of Hamas winning. But he has banked his career on a negotiated two-state solution with Israel. And now that this comes along, it makes that look like a fool's errand. And so there's no doubt that this has the potential to embolden his rivals and undercut his ability to lead. So that is one of the major consequences of this.
Now, there have been some responses within Israel. I mean, the Knesset has come up with a vote that says that if there's going to be a change of the boundaries of Jerusalem as part of a peace deal, that would require ratification by a supermajority. Yeah. What's the impact of that?
The impact is that if we are ever going to see a two-state solution, part of that solution is going to have to mean that the Palestinians are going to be able to have their capital in some part, eastern part of the city, which is predominantly populated by Palestinians. And so what they're saying is this very hawkish right-wing government led by Prime Minister Netanyahu, that by trying to mandate now that it would be a two-thirds vote, a referendum of sorts, that would make that impossible. So that even if you achieve this incredibly difficult feat of a negotiated settlement, it could fail on that premise, that they wouldn't have that majority. And the left, the Labor, and the other parties in the left in Israel are very weak right now. And they're going to be weak for the foreseeable future, as far as I can tell, if you read the political map. What President Trump's Jerusalem decision did, among other things, if it wildly undercut Mahmoud Abbas, it emboldened this right-wing forces in Israel, not only to call for a supermajority on Jerusalem, but it led to people like Naftali Bennett, the education minister, who's very hawkish, to say they should annex the West Bank. Yeah. So it's going to have that kind of potential to further drive Netanyahu to the right.
Now, globally, there's been a response. There was a vote in the UN General Assembly basically reproaching President Trump for taking this decision. The vote was 128-9. At the same time, there are reports that the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, Prince Mohammed bin Salman, has in fact summoned Abbas to Riyadh and asked him to accept a deal that would be very hard to swallow and certainly impossible to sell to the Palestinians. What do you know about that conversation and the content of the deal put forth?
Well, we don't know exactly. All we know is what was reported about the deal, which was something far short of what Mahmoud Abbas would be able to accept in terms of territory for the Palestinians, for starters. But what we do know is that Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law and Middle East envoy, who's been tasked with negotiating an Israeli-Palestinian settlement, made several trips to Mohammed bin Salman, the young crown prince of Saudi Arabia, right before the crown prince basically sort of launched a coup within the country and arrested scores of princes, held them hostage in two hotels in Riyadh, confiscated their assets, and basically filled the Saudi coffers, which are hurting because of lower oil prices and because of the dependence of a vast majority of that population on subsidized goods. So we know that there was a meeting, and the way it looks is that, to me, and this is really speculation because I'm not on the ground reporting and this has been very closed off, but that he received MBS, as he's called, Mohammed bin Salman, some kind of okay from Jared Kushner that whatever you want to do internally, that's fine. That's fine. We're not going to criticize. And in fact, you had President Trump, right after Jared Kushner's visit, come out on Twitter and applaud Mohammed bin Salman for his leadership and his fight against quote-unquote corruption, with no criticism of Mohammed bin Salman's own personal largesse and alleged corruption. And the same time, and maybe in return, he won something from Mohammed bin Salman. And that was support for what Jared Kushner appears to be trying to do, or at least at that time was trying to do in negotiating a settlement. So you had Mahmoud Abbas summoned, told to support this peace deal, again, the parameters of which are not 100% clear. And you also saw in the aftermath of President Trump's announcement on Jerusalem in December that the response from the Saudis and the Egyptians and other states that you would expect to be critical was very muted.
So I know that we don't know the full contours of the deal that that the Crown Prince advanced. Do we have any sense of what it means for the right of return? Any sense of what it means for for settlements? Will that land be annexed? What do we know?
We don't really know. The only thing that was really reported was that it would be some sort of it wouldn't be a full return of the West Bank or even a West Bank return to the Palestinian control that was contiguous. There were problems. There were very few details reported. And when Jared Kushner gave a speech, it wasn't really a speech. It was an interview by Chaim Saban at the Saban Center in Washington, the Brookings Institution. He was very oblique about what he was cooking up with the other negotiators. In my view, it really may not matter now because of the Jerusalem announcement. I feel like this has so undercut the Americans' ability to negotiate that whatever he puts forward may not even matter at this point.
Mm-hmm. Was he compromised, or at least his legitimacy as a possible mediator, compromised by the fact that his family has supported the settlements financially? Of course, the same can be said about our ambassador to Israel, Ambassador Friedman. He, too, has provided financial support to the settlements. Has that fact harmed their ability to serve as mediators in any event?
I think all of it together makes this a difficult proposition. I mean, David Friedman, as you mentioned, the U.S. ambassador to Israel, supports settlements, does not even sanction the use of the word occupation. Mm. He is not exactly perceived as someone who can be an honest, neutral broker in all of this. Now, that doesn't mean that, I mean, fundamentally, the way this has worked since the signing of the Oslo Accords is 93, is there's kind of been the United States brings along Israel with its security guarantees for the state. And the Europeans kind of help bring the Palestinians along with financial aid. There's been this whole thing's been blown up now. There's no clear sense that the United States can be neutral, at least under President Trump. The New York Times reported in early January on the Kushner Company receiving a $30 million investment from an Israeli, I think it was an insurance, I don't remember if it was an insurance firm, but, and so there are these kinds of connections that again, I think undermine their ability to broker a deal in the eyes of the Palestinians. In addition, Trump has threatened to cut off aid to UNRWA, which is the UN agency that supports Palestinian refugees, provides vital services to millions of Palestinian refugees and their descendants. And he's also threatened to close the PLO office in Washington. So putting this all together, I don't think there's any serious observer of this that really thinks that Trump would be able, or his proxies would be able, would be considered a neutral, honest broker in the peace process for a two-state solution.
So there's the aid you've referred to a UN agency, but there's also the bilateral aid. I think it's something like $400 million a year. President Trump has threatened to cut that off. In the past, we've always used aid as inducements for concessions made at the negotiating table. Is President Trump trying to use the withholding of aid as a kind of club to force concessions, or is he simply walking away from the process?
I think it's both. I mean, he's doing this everywhere, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, he set up Nikki Haley at the UN to have to come out and say, we're cutting aid if you don't support us, mm-hmm. right? She said, we're taking names on that vote that you referenced about the Jerusalem issue. And he just did this on Pakistan as well. Okay, now the Pakistan thing is a little more complicated. Previous administrations have halted aid to the military aid to the Pakistanis after they had a nuclear test, for example, years back. But in this case, I think he doesn't like giving internet foreign aid. He doesn't see the value, and so he's finding excuses not to give it. Now, if I'm Prime Minister Netanyahu, though, and I'm looking at the situation, you're going to cut off $400 million to the Palestinians, and you're going to cut off other hundreds of millions to UNRWA. Who's going to provide for those services? Mm-hmm. The Israelis have a very important security relationship with Mahmoud Abbas, okay? And so unless the Israelis are going back in full force and taking control of all of what is known as Area A, which the Palestinians control, then someone's got to provide these services and help pay these wages. So I think that it's a very short-sighted and potentially dangerous decision to cut off any of that aid.
Mm-hmm. Is it likely that the U.S. will have to walk that threat backwards?
Yes.
Yep, highly likely.
I think so. I mean, right now, it's very hard to prognosticate on these things because we're in such uncharted territory, but I don't see this. I mean, he's also threatened, I think, well, has it been recently on Egypt? There were threats. So I think this whole aid question is very concerning.
Let's talk a little bit about domestic politics as well. Netanyahu is under investigation on corruption charges. If that government were to fall, you'd have to move forward the elections. Are we seeing posturing and positioning around this issue that is influenced by that fact as well? Kind of a playing to the base?
Yeah, I think that there is this sense that and I mean, one of the interpretations on the ground in Israel is that Netanyahu is weak because of the investigations, the corruption investigations. And so you've got people taking advantage of that and putting forward these extremely right-wing positions in the Knesset and whatever, thinking they can bring him along because he's so weak and needs his coalition to stay intact. But Netanyahu has proven himself to be a survivor. I'm not convinced that his demise is imminent. And if there is going to be any change in the Israeli polity, unfortunately, I think it's going to be to the right. Mm-hmm. In terms of the extreme right. I think that Netanyahu is rightist. He's Likudnik, but he's also very smart and he understands things. And it was interesting, for example, on the question of, you know, whether or not the U.S. should cut aid to UNRWA. And at first there were reports saying that he did not agree with this. And then he came out suddenly and said, oh yeah, sure. So my sense is that maybe Trump or somebody came to him and said, you know, you got to get in line with the president on this. But I think his instincts are he knows that aid is essential and that there could be a real crisis if it's cut. So I think he's sort of caught. But Netanyahu is a brilliant tactician. If he's one thing he knows, he knows how to navigate his political survival. So I think it's too early to prognosticate on whether he's going to be upended with new elections.
Prime Minister Netanyahu also understands American domestic politics very, very well. Tell me how that could have influenced the president's decision.
So I actually think that Prime Minister Netanyahu had very little to do with Trump's Jerusalem decision. I think this was primarily an American domestic concern. One of his top donors, Sheldon Adelson, the Las Vegas casino magnate, was berating him, pressuring him, threatening to cut off aid to his cause, Trump's cause, if he didn't announce that Jerusalem was the capital of Israel and that the United States was moving the embassy there, which, by the way, when we should mention that when Trump said he was recognizing that Jerusalem was the capital of Israel, he said he was directing the State Department to begin the process of relocating the embassy. But there's nothing actually happened there, and that's going to take years. So really, it's a very symbolic gesture, although a fraught one, as I mentioned, that undercuts the U.S. ability to mediate. So I think Sheldon Adelson, Christian Zionists, hardcore supporters of the president, were delighted with this move. And I just didn't see Netanyahu really pushing for it.
Yeah. Now, we talked a little bit about the kind of gap between what our friends in the sort of Israel's neighbors are saying publicly and what they're saying privately. I mean, here you've got the crown prince who had objected publicly, or at least Saudi Arabia had objected publicly to this move. The Egyptians objected to this move, but we're told, at least in the kind of coverage you see in the New York Times and elsewhere, that in fact these friends of ours are acquiescing, that they've got other fish to fry. What is their list of concerns, and where does the fate of the Palestinians fall in that hierarchy of concerns?
Yeah, I think that right now, look, we're looking at the Middle East right now. If we take a step back, in a post 2011 Arab Spring Middle East, as opposed to, say, a 2000 Middle East at Camp David, when President Clinton was trying to muscle Ehud Barak and Yasser Arafat to a deal on Jerusalem, and then all the monarchies and everybody like, what? You didn't even consult with us, barely. So we're in it was just a different world right now. So you've got a situation where in Saudi Arabia and Egypt and all these strong Sunni Arab states where their primary concern is Iran. And they're looking at President Trump for support on Israel. And there are people who say that actually this is really helping Netanyahu because he's also against Iran. So maybe there's a way for them to be together and unite against this broader Shia crescent threat that they are outlining. Now, internally, Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman is trying to consolidate power. And he's interested in domestic issues. The Palestinian issue is very low on his priority list right now, even as the homeland of Mecca and the protector of the mosques. And so you have that disconnect, as you mentioned. He's got to say something publicly, but privately he really wants to consolidate power and he wants to fight Iran, and he's dealing with this horrific war in Yemen right now. In Egypt, you have a similar situation with President Sisi, where he's still trying to consolidate his power and just wants to please Trump. Right now, a lot of these leaders, like a lot of the world internationally, are trying to figure out how to deal with this erratic president of the United States. And so part of this is also about you want to make sure you seem in line with him if you want to have good relations with the United States right now. Very few countries are choosing to actually battle with Trump publicly, if you notice. I mean, there are some, but very few.
So this suggests that there are leaders who are really cowed by President Trump's approach. In many respects, isn't this his goal?
I guess so. But the question is, what is his objective?
Mm-hmm.
He said he was going to do, what did he say, the greatest deal, or he's the greatest deal maker, he's going to make a peace deal. You're not making a peace deal,
yeah.
Right? What are you going to do on Iran right now? You're going to pull out of the Iran nuclear deal? Well, how's that going to help anybody? It's an international deal. How are you going to pull out unilaterally from that? How's that going to affect Boeing, who's investing in Iran? You're so worried about the stock market. What are you going to replace it with? You know, his knowledge and depth on these matters and his ultimate objective in the Middle East and more broadly internationally is really incoherent.
On the assumption that the deal put forth by the Crown Prince is, in fact, what Jared Kushner had in mind, might the administration be looking for a deal that's not a negotiated deal? So that is to say, you change the facts on the ground regarding Jerusalem. You ensure that the neighbors of Israel coalesce around a point of view, and that point of view takes hold.
You know, the closest we've come in the past is U.S. presidents trying to outline what a peace deal would look like. So, for example, when Camp David broke down, President Clinton put out the Clinton parameters that outlined what should happen on the final status issues of Jerusalem, security, refugees, and borders. But to try and say that the U.S. would dictate this is the final peace deal without having a Palestinian agreement to it makes no sense.
Now, back to Iran for a moment. One of the big concerns on the minds of Egypt, Saudi Arabia, others, you covered the Arab Spring, is what's happening in Iran right now part of that? Is it of similar importance, or is it something much more short-lived, much less significant?
Look, we don't know right now. We're still in the very beginning stages of this. We know that unlike what was called the Green Revolution of a few years back in Iran, which was really led by sort of perceived as the intellectuals in Tehran, mm-hmm. and it was quickly shut down. This has started out in what is more traditionally the Ayatollah's, what's considered his base, I guess, of the rural areas, a labor-oriented movement. People fed up with subsidies for the religious clerics, wanting to. It's more of an economic grievance thing. Now, it doesn't mean that it hasn't also become mixed up with political grievances against the Shia religious leadership there and their seizing of the resources. But we don't know how it's going to end. One of the things that Iranians expected after the signing of the nuclear deal was that their economy would improve. And a lot of that hasn't really trickled down. And part of the reason is potentially because of the uncertainty about President Trump. This brings mm-hmm. it back to Trump. Companies are not investing with the gusto necessarily that they would have because they're unsure if he's going to pull out. And what would that right. mean to make that kind of investment? So I think some of that is part of it, but a lot of this is internal. And so I think that it was perhaps not wise for everyone, for U.S. leaders and other leaders to come out and say, yes, go for it, rah, rah, we're with you. I mean, what does that mean, we're with you? It doesn't always work out very well when you're saying you're going to support people and then you don't necessarily do that. And it made me think of times when the U.S. said they would, in Iraq, a long time ago, and they said they would support people to have an uprising against Saddam Hussein. I think the United States has to be very careful in its rhetoric on this and not assume that this is actually a revolution calling for regime change. It may just be more, you know, for more economic reforms and better pay and things like that.
And it may not be that helpful to signal American support. After all, that gives the conservative clerics the ability to say, gee, this is not the yearnings of our publics. This is something that has been stirred up by external forces and our enemies, in essence.
Yeah, I think that's correct.
So it started in Iran, from what we understand. It started as a result of President Rouhani releasing or making publicly available the national budget, something that hasn't been done before. In many respects, that's the kind of thing, that's good governance, right? That's the kind of thing we would encourage. It turned out to be unwise.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the thing. He was actually trying to do something there. To be more transparent, but yeah, what it revealed were these disparities that people just, you know, got fed up with. So
it's funds going to the religious institutions,
right.
to the military, but being taken away from various subsidies being denied to the public. Is that right?
Yes, precisely. And now, you know, you've got this. I think the thing to watch going forward is whether you'll have more of a. A groundswell of revolt that is also tapping into the other discontent among the people who pursued the Green Revolution several years ago in terms of opposing this strict religious leadership in Tehran overall. And if it becomes more of a groundswell. Now, they're doing the same thing that they tried to do, that Hosni Mubarak tried to do by cutting off social media, trying to limit people's ability to organize, trying to stage pro-government protests, the kind of things I witnessed in Bahrain and Egypt when I covered the 2011 revolutions. And it really just a matter of time to see how this plays out. It's very hard to tell at this point.
As you think about the pressures, on the one hand, it's a very young population, and it's an educated population, and these might be folks that are impatient for change on the one hand. But on the other hand, you can argue it's a middle-class society. It may be folks with a real interest in stability and more interested in an evolution than in some kind of abrupt change. How do you balance those two as you think out into the future?
I mean, look, the changes in Iran, I think people say are going to come. And it's more a matter of when and how long can this regime that has lasted since 1979 actually remain in power. But it's a very strong regime with a lot of resources at its disposal to crush internal dissent. So clearly it hasn't played out the way it has in other countries that have gone through revolutions in the Middle East. And again, I'm not sure what's going to be the deciding factor that's going to either lead to an absolute revolution that ousts Ayatollah and all of the whole clerical regime. I mean, I think we're still a ways off from a restoration of democracy in Iran.
If it were to cause that kind of disruption, what would it mean for us if you had that kind of, in fact, chaos in Syria, in Yemen, and in Iran? What does that do for our interests and for the region?
Well, I mean, there are a lot of people who are clamoring, actually, for this kind of revolution in Iran because they see the Iranian regime and the Revolutionary Guards and their support for terrorist groups and for Assad and for Hezbollah in Lebanon and for the Houthis in Yemen as the main evil in the region right now. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure that people would necessarily be upset about it. Now, that what kind of instability that kind of revolution would usher in, I don't know. We don't actually have any good models right now for a nice, neat revolution that puts someone in power that is somebody we're really excited about in the United States. So I think it's all very risky. I'm not saying that there shouldn't be or should. I'm just saying that when you look at what happened and what the cataclysm of, not cataclysm, but the just complete change in the region that erupted starting in 2011, when we're still trying to digest that. And in many ways, the revolutions have failed.
Yeah.
So in terms of what we would like to see, if what we like to see, who's we, though, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, under President George W. Bush, he said after 9/11 that we're changing our Middle East policy because decades of supporting dictatorships did not bring us safety and peace. So he went for democracy promotion. President Obama inherited the Arab revolutions and what was happening there, and he took a much more cautious approach, although did ultimately side with the idea that Hosni Mubarak should leave in Egypt, we should say. And now President Trump seems to prefer autocracy and dictatorship in terms of his embrace of President Sisi in Egypt and Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia, has no mention of human rights or freedom in any of his statements on foreign policy. So he might be content just leaving these dictatorships in place throughout the region. But in terms of Iran, he's definitely taking the side of those who believe that only regime change is the only thing that we can really work with on Iran. And we're going to be looking in the next couple weeks at something very consequential in terms of the Iran nuclear deal. And Congress has to make a decision about what to do about sanctions, given that the president didn't certify the Iran nuclear deal as he should have.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And despite evidence.
Right.
That
despite
they are
all the agencies saying they're actually upholding this deal.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, we don't know what the end game is to those who are in the streets. I mean, as you know, some are about the economy, some are about freedom. We don't know what that end game is. But we do know that Iranians have voted for reform candidates, at least in the context of Iran, over the past several years. So maybe gradual change is what is sought.
Maybe.
Thank you so much, Janine Zakaria.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. You can reach us at worldaffairs.org. We were in conversation with Janine Zakaria, the former Jerusalem bureau chief for the Washington Post, and David Sanger, the chief Washington correspondent for the New York Times. This broadcast was made possible by the support of Chevron and the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation. I'd like to bring our listeners up to date on an exciting addition to our show. I've invited two veteran reporters to join me as co-hosts. The first is Ray Suarez. Ray is known to our listeners as the former chief national correspondent for the PBS NewsHour. He was also anchor of NPR's Talk of the Nation. He's a great journalist and a good friend. He'll be joining us from his home base at Amherst College in Massachusetts. Joining Ray and me will be Marcos Kounoulakis. He's a former Newsweek reporter, and he's now based at Stanford's Hoover Institution. We'll be handing off the moderating responsibilities among us, but at times we'll also appear together to share our observations of issues in the news. We hope that you too will join us for these sessions, either at World Affairs headquarters in San Francisco or online. If you do, you'll help ensure that our conversations are in fact conversations that matter. World Affairs is a partnership with KQED Public Radio. It's made possible by the generous support of Chevron and the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation. Our technical supervisor is Monte Carlos. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.